Okay, so today is December 10th, 2014. This is a follow-up interview with Steve Glass. He was part of an interview I conducted in September with Dave Egan, Bill Jordan, and himself. My name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. So Steve, for sound quality purposes, could you say your last name and, or say your full name and spell your last name?
Steve Glass, G-L-A-S-S.
Excellent. Okay, I'm going to just slide this a touch closer to you. You don't need to speak up, but I'm going to have to probably speak up a little bit to make sure my questions get on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we talked before we turned on the recorder, and I think we're going to start with some of the major projects you did at the Arboretum. You started with some subheadings of initiatives or contributions to the restoration ecology program that you were a part of that you wanted to talk about. So let's start there and sort of see where we go from there.
Okay, I think we could divide it in a couple ways. One is the contributions of the Arboretum in general,
Okay. And
then the contributions that I participated in or initiated while I worked at the Arboretum. So the Arboretum in general is known as the birthplace of restoration ecology, although it wasn't called that when in 1934 they began planting and trying to restore what's now known as Curtis Prairie. That wasn't perhaps the very first one, but it was part of a group that happened in the 1920s, 1930s around the country in small or big college campuses. And at the Arboretum, they developed the several techniques for planting, several techniques for prairie site preparation. John Curtis and Max Parch, through a series of elegant experiments, proved that prescribed fire is essential to manage prairies. Although the use of fire was known, has been known for a long time as a helpful tool for managing land, it wasn't proven until 1948 that it was critical for restoring and managing prairies. A lot of research was conducted at the Arboretum that has advanced the field of ecology and restoration ecology, and a big thing that came out of the involvement of John Curtis at the Arboretum was his landmark book, The Vegetation of Wisconsin, which is still in print. And in that book, he and his students studied the 60 or 70, so don't hold me to that number, different kinds of plant communities found in Wisconsin, what they might have looked like before white settlers started disrupting them. And that book is used as a baseline for designing and planting a lot of restoration projects, both in Wisconsin and in the upper Midwest. And really, I don't think any other state in the Midwest has a book quite like The Vegetation of Wisconsin. And also, the Arboretum made contributions to the field of environmental education. It was an early center for school naturalists and naturalist tour guides to take elementary school and sometimes high school kids on tours to show them natural areas and talk about restoration works. It has a long history of that involvement. And because the university had the Arboretum, it was able to establish a restoration ecology program here out of the Landscape Architecture Department. And that program, when I was in school and when Dave Egan was in school, was probably the only one in the country, and now there are dozens all over the country. Mm-hmm. But that program produced lots of students over the years, and the cohort of students that Dave and I were in have gone on to management positions in the DNR, at the Nature Conservancy, with the Prairie Enthusiasts, with the Audubon Society. So that Landscape Architecture Restoration Ecology program has provided a large number of people to staff and lead environmental administration programs. And I think that program was made possible because they had this Arboretum restoration program underway. The Arboretum also was where Bill Jordan and Keith Wendt coined the term restoration ecology. And he had a pioneering journal called Ecological Restoration. First it was called Restoration and Management Notes, and then it became Ecological Restoration. And that was the first journal that had project profiles about restoration projects. So I went to school, as we noted in the last interview, in the Landscape Architecture Department, got my degree in restoration ecology. I was the first person trained and educated as a restoration ecologist to be hired by the Arboretum, although subsequently there have been several others. And I think the contributions that myself and my staff and my fellow colleagues at the time made are in several areas. One was in prescribed fire management. And during my tenure at the Arboretum, we conducted close to 300 prescribed management burns of the various woods, prairies, and wetlands. And I'm proud to say that we did that without personal injury or property damage. We professionalized the burn crew in that all the burn crew members received a national certification in a program offered by the Nature Conservancy and the National Wildfire Coordinating Group, which trains and certifies people to be members of a burn crew. And that was the first time that that's happened at the Arboretum, was when I had my crew get trained. We began the practice of writing prescribed fire prescriptions, which is a document that spells out under what conditions a burn will be conducted and what conditions it won't be. We started a prescribed burn database wherein we kept track of the burns that we conducted and a description of the results. And then we began burning of some of the Arboretum's outlying properties. These are remnant plant communities that were acquired by the Arboretum in the 60s. They were largely purchased by the Nature Conservancy, who at that time wasn't managing natural areas, and looked to the Arboretum as a place to manage them. So we began the burning of several outlying prairies, including Fayville, Paskflower Hill, Bolts Prairie, and Oliver Prairie. In terms of ecological restoration, during the time I was there, my crew and volunteer colleagues, I think we maintained and enhanced a number of restorations and maintained and enhanced a number of remnant plant communities. The restorations that we worked really hard on and I think did a good job on include Curtis Prairie, Green Prairie, Winger Overlook Prairie, Winger Woods, Galistel Woods, and Noe Woods. And then the natural communities that I think we also did a good job on in terms of enhancing their ecological attributes were Abraham's Woods, Bolts Prairie, Fayville Prairie, Oliver Prairie, Paskflower Hill, and Winger Fen. That was hard work. A lot of people were involved, and I don't take sole credit for it, but I think that one of the accomplishments I'm proud of is that we professionalized the field staff, and we hired a number of student workers who were receiving training in restoration ecology, so they came on board with knowledge of pest plant control. Many of them had become burn certified while they were in school, and that just enhanced our ability to do burns. Another area in which I think we made some advancement was in the field of pest plant control. A lot of colleagues call it invasive species management, but I prefer to call it pest plant control, because invasive species has a connotation that these plants often from abroad have some sort of conspiracy to take over the world and have a mind of their own and are invading our native areas. When in fact, these are plants that humans brought either intentionally or accidentally, and through human disruption of the ecosystem, we've provided a niche for these species. And not all of them are problematic, only a subset. And so those the plants that are problematic, that interfere with management goals, are considered pests. Anyway, we developed some techniques and procedures for control of buckthorn and honeysuckle. We developed a pest plant risk assessment, understanding that we couldn't tackle all 60 or 70 species that were considered problems, so we had to tackle only the worst. And we came up with a prioritized list of those. We developed some protocols for safe and effective use of herbicides and installed some equipment and storage cabinets in the headquarters that made that minimized human exposure to these chemicals and lived up to OSHA standards. And I think I can say that we eliminated buckthorn and honeysuckle from a number of plant communities, including Winger and Galistel Woods, Winger Fen. We also eliminated a number of biennial herbaceous weeds, including the sweet clovers, wild parsnip, Queen Anne's lace from the prairies. And established the Arboretum Weed Warriors, which is a group of volunteers who went out, scouted for locations of pest plants, and actually worked at pulling them or digging them or whatever control method we outlined. Also, there, after Joy Zedler, the Leopold professor, came on board in 1998, I believe, then we were able to work on her notion of adaptive management, whereby researchers and land managers work together to solve problems and come up with improved techniques. And we worked on a number of projects where this adaptive management, sort of learning by doing, was employed with some success.
Do you mind if I ask some follow-up questions?
Absolutely,
about?
Yeah.
So the first thing you talked about, it kind of went on through a lot of it, was the idea of prescribed burning and prescribed
mm-hmm.
fire.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there's a way you can verbalize, perhaps an example of a prescribed burn to kind of give us what you and your staff would do. Obviously there were protocols you had to follow, but
mm-hmm.
once you decided something was going to be burned,
mm-hmm.
how did that day or days of burning look?
Oh, that's a good question. You start with the prescription, which spells out the weather conditions. These are the conditions of temperature, a temperature range, a humidity range, a wind speed range, a wind direction. And so you look for a day where those parameters are met or likely to be met sometime during the day. And the temperature range is usually between 45 and 75. The humidity is usually between 25 and 60. And below those ranges, for temperature, below 45, it's probably too cold to have an effective burn, and above 75, it's too volatile. So these are conditions that are designed to give you a safe, manageable burn, probably not a burn that is going to achieve the greatest ecological benefit, but it's sets up a condition that you can conduct a burn safely in an urban setting. So you start out the day, you check the weather forecasts, see if your burn conditions are going to be met. If you think they are, you contact the permanent crew and the volunteer crew who've said they're available, just to confirm that they are available and establish a start time, establish a reporting time. So you may start your burn at 10, ask people to be there at 9:30, get equipped, get a pre-burn briefing. You notify the authorities and the neighbors that you are likely to have a fire that morning. You assemble on the site. You do a walkthrough, so everyone familiarizes themselves with the site, the hazards and escape routes and potential problems and things to look out for during the burn, and answer questions and assign responsibilities. People are usually divided into two crews, each with a crew leader and a primary burn boss. You do a little test burn just to see if things are going to pan out the way you hope that they will.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do, and everybody agrees that we can go ahead, everybody's comfortable, then we can go ahead and light it. And a typical burn will take an hour or two.
So a test burn is how big?
Oh, a test burn is maybe as big as this table.
All right.
So which is what? Four by six?
Yeah, four by six, maybe four by eight. So
yeah. So just to give you an idea of, is the smoke going to be blowing in the direction you want? Is the fire going to be too hot to handle? Is it going to be manageable?
Do you recall projects or prescribed burns where you did the test burn, things looked fine, you start the burn, and weather happened or things happened that you had to stop it? And
there were a couple like that where actually we did call them off. And those were cases where the weather forecast did not pan out.
Is there a better time in the day, within obviously these ranges of, mm-hmm. of temperature and humidity, but is there a better time in the day to do it? Do you want to try to burn first thing in the morning, late in the afternoon? Does it matter?
It does matter. Probably not first thing in the morning, because the fuel still may be wet from dew and your crew isn't available. It's probably not a good idea to burn in the middle of the afternoon when that's when the temperature is going to be the highest and the humidity the lowest. A good time of day to do it is towards dusk, when the temperature has dropped and the humidity has risen a bit. But we often burned in mid-morning, often about 10 o'clock, which was roughly equivalent to burning at near dusk, when the conditions were moderate, not extreme.
And what kind of acreage are we talking about in total that these burns would cover?
Some burns would be 4 or 5 acres. Other burns would be 40 or 50.
Okay. So a pretty wide range of...
Pretty wide range. We would have a crew from 8 to 12, depending on the size of the burn and the complexity.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
So you talked about restoration ecology projects, and you listed some of them. So, you know, prescribed burns, there's a plan. You get the plan done, mm-hmm. and then, a good day, it's done in a couple mm-hmm. hours.
Right.
Restoration ecology, I assume, is not that simple. Or is it? So I guess my question is there a way to look at one of those on the list and give us sort of an overview of what it means to do or what steps are involved in a restoration ecology project?
Prescribed burning is one restoration tool. It's one restoration step. And it's probably the most efficient and effective use of personnel, because the actual burn will be accomplished in, as I said, 2 or 3 hours.
So is burning then, did burning happen in all those ecological restoration projects, those 6 or 7 there?
No, not all of them. Some of them were in plant communities that are not fire dependent or not fire tolerant. So, for example, Wingra Woods and Galistow Woods, those were restorations or recreations of woodland communities that might have occurred in Wisconsin at one point in time. I can give you an example. Let's take Wingra Woods, and we'll talk about pest plant control in context of Wingra Woods.
Okay.
And one step that's often necessary for restoration, but oftentimes not sufficient in and of itself, is removing pest plants. And in the case of Wingra Woods, that was garlic mustard a little bit. But early on, it was buckthorn, Rhamnus cathartica, and honeysuckle, Lunicera expella. And those became established in the Arboretum and elsewhere in the Madison area in the 60s. And it wasn't until herbicides became available and permitted for use in the Arboretum in the early 70s that there was any effective control. So the two species that I mentioned are woody shrubs, and if you cut the stems in an effort to reduce the above-ground biomass, you get resprouts. So if you cut one stem, you usually get 5 to 10 that come back. So the Arboretum and other areas that we're managing for these species had a tough time controlling them, and a lot of futile effort went into it, simply cutting and then watching the plant resprout. So it wasn't until I think the mid to late 70s that Evelyn Howell and Virginia Klein in the Landscape Architecture Department, and Virginia Klein at the Arboretum, did some tests on effective and efficient use of herbicides versus manual control. And they did a nice little study and showed the Arboretum committee, the Faculty Governance Committee, that the use of herbicide was essential, and they got permission to use it. And this was happening at other places, too, that were managing lands. And so it wasn't until the mid to late 70s that there was actually a technique available for controlling these shrubs. And when I came on board in 1989, I realized that the herbicide they were using for control of the shrubs, Roundup or glyphosate, was not effective in the way that they were using it. So we developed some techniques through some trial and error experiments that showed another chemical, Garlon or triclifer, would be an effective tool. And so we got permission from the Arboretum Committee to do that, to use that chemical. And so I think in about 1990, 1991, then we began using Garlon in a systematic way to control buckthorn and honeysuckle in Wingra Woods, Galistow Woods, and Noe Woods. And by systematic, I mean that we had designated days during the week, designated times, designated crews that would go out and spend for 3 hours in a marked-off area in pairs, one person cutting and another person applying herbicide. And it took us 5 or 6 years of work in the fall to get rid of those species. And by get rid of them, I mean that we eliminated any fruiting plants and we eliminated reproduction on site. Those two species are always going to find their way back in because they're bird dispersed. But at least we got rid of the reproducing populations and got rid of the canopy of those two species and allowed the wildflowers to grow. So that's just an example of a restoration. One project, it takes a long time, it takes a lot of planning and a lot of hard work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, there was something, again, in the notes, the follow-up email you sent to me that I probably should have had you start with, but I think it'd be, we need to talk about it at some point because I think you're right. And you said, as a footnote, I'd also like to discuss what it is we mean when we say arboretum. So you say it has several identities. So maybe you could go through what you said when you meant that the arboretum has several identities.
Yeah, that's a good switch. And before I get to that, I just want to say, in terms of the restoration initiatives, looking back on my career at the Arboretum, the amount of time that I had to devote pretty much exclusively with my staff and volunteers to restoration lasted from 1989 when I started till about 1999 or 2000. After that, in 1999, and I mentioned I also wanted to talk about some turning points. Mm-hmm. And I think one of those turning points was the design and building of a addition to the visitor center and the installation of a 4-acre Wisconsin native plant garden. Those were designed to appeal to what the director at the time thought was an underserved audience, or an audience that had a different opinion of what the arboretum is or should be. I think that visitor center addition and the accompanying native plant garden proved to be a mistake. It was a mistake because the director Greg Armstrong, used one-time funding. He raised almost $3 million, but it was just one time, to initiate a project that took on long-term cost in the operating budget, for which there was no... So to get to your question, I'm going to rely on an arboretum self-study that was conducted in the year 2000 when Kevin McSweeney was the director. And this is a synthesis of that self-study and a comparison with previous strategic plans conducted by staff colleague at the time, Marion Ferrier. And she did a wonderful job in condensing the work of the self-study, which I'll describe in a minute, and the themes that emerged from it, and the themes in the previous strategic plans. So there was a strategic plan adopted in the year 2000, Strategic Plan 2000, and that was a plan that took about a year to develop with the input of all staff, faculty colleagues, and the Arboretum Governance Committee. And then there was an attempt in 2004, on the eve of Director Armstrong's retirement, to come up with another strategic plan that sort of revised the 2000 plan. And that's the 2004 strategic plan, which was never adopted by the Faculty Governance Committee. So the, in the view of myself and other colleagues I've conferred with, the building of the Wisconsin Native Plant Garden and the addition to the Visitor Center was a huge project, almost $3 million. It diverted staff, energy, and resources and time from land care to caring for managing this project. And it also led to a staff reorganization, which created a lot of staff turmoil and just threw the organization into disarray. All this is leading up to telling you about this self-study, which was an attempt to, by the Arboretum Director McSweeney and the Arboretum Committee, to sort of come to grips with what was troubling the organization, what was causing all this staff turmoil and disarray. So, just quoting from the document, the sound of me turning pages. Let's see. The study and the self-study was conducted by a group of faculty in the Arboretum Governance Committee, wherein they interviewed every single staff member and many members of the Arboretum Faculty Governance Committee itself, either individually or in smaller work groups. So this was a free-flowing discussion, and the Arboretum Committee members who led the study wanted to hear people tell them about the organization's strengths and weaknesses and opportunities and constraints. And so they did. I mean, this was just people emptied their guts. So the conclusions of the study was that the Arboretum, as a dysfunctional, balkanized organization, little organizational cohesion. The organization cultivates an individualistic ethic that allows staff to dabble in many aspects of environmental education or other areas in addition to restoration ecology. It found that although the Arboretum has a strong worldwide reputation in the restoration community, and that the local community understands that restoration is the organizing principle, restoration is not really understood well by the local public, and there's little enthusiasm for or interest in the actual science and practice of restoration, although people love to come out and volunteer. They love to go to volunteer work parties. But those are often one-time events and doesn't contribute much to the learning about restoration. And the study found that the Arboretum has a sort of a mixed identity in the community. It's viewed as a recreation site. It's viewed as a place for bird watching and running and walking and skiing. And it's a nature study area. It's valued for its horticultural gardens, including the lilac collection. Maybe you've been to the lilac collection. It's wonderful. It's the best lilac collection in the Midwest. If not the country, it has a fantastic crabapple collection, and people value it for that. Those are all wonderful things that contribute to society. But the self-study found that the Arboretum was trying to do too many things with too few resources. So the question comes up, these valuable things that add to the community, are they essential to be done at the Arboretum, whose founding principle was restoration ecology. So all of these demands to meet these different audiences in the community really puts a lot of stress on the staff trying to meet all these sometimes competing demands. And it just led to an organization now that I think has sort of lost its way. Sad to say. Did I answer the question about the publics, or do I need to go into more depth about that?
Maybe a bit more about the publics. I was actually going to ask something to that effect, so maybe if you want to go in a bit more, and then I'll see
okay.
where it leads.
Well, there's the public that's interested in the horticultural gardens, the crab apples and the lilacs. There's the public that is concerned about the deer that sometimes live in the arboretum eating their shrubs. There's the public that is concerned about coyotes, which are omnipresent in the urban environment. Somehow are the arboretum's responsibility, and they're concerned that coyote is going to eat their little poodle, which is a legitimate concern, possibly. There's the recreational community, which includes bikers, runners, walkers, skiers. Those people are all welcome, but it takes time to manage them, and they're a separate constituency. It takes time to burn a prairie and control pest plants, and in the arboretum's world, where you also have to accommodate recreational users, that's a competing use of your time. There's the public who wants the arboretum to take on a leadership role in watershed issues. The arboretum is in the Lake Winger watershed. And the arboretum doesn't have the people power or the resources to manage the watershed. So that's an expectation by a segment of the public that's unmet. So all those things are very frustrating to not be able to achieve those goals.
So you said that the faculty committee didn't approve the self...
They approved the self-study. The self-study was in 2007. They approved it in 2008. What wasn't approved was Director Armstrong's initiative for revised... strategic plan in 2004. And he initiated the planning effort in late 2003, announced his retirement in early 2004, retired 6 months later. In the meantime, he tried to continue with this strategic planning process, and it was never approved by the Arboretum Committee.
Mm. Now, it was, I think it was sometime in this period, Dave was talking about it earlier, that a document about, now I'm flipping through pages.
That's fine, that's fine. There's a lot of paperwork.
The possible arboretum scenario, is that the 2004 revised? Dave said in 2004 he was on a director search committee. A lot of planning work, and then he said that you and he started talking about possible scenarios for the arboretum.
Yes, that was a think piece that Dave and I worked on, just ourselves, to try to come to grips with the arboretum's different identities. And so this is nothing we ever published. It was a think piece that we came up with, and I think we came up with 8 or 10 different possible scenarios, each one catered to a different public expectation of what the Arboretum should be. So the Nature Center. And the Nature Center is a place that shows exhibits of taxidermied animals and shows samples of twigs and leaves and takes people on hikes. And that's a wonderful thing to contribute to society, and there are many nature centers. But the question Dave and I had, is this something that the Arboretum should devote its scarce resources to? So I don't think that I can do that scenario planning justice because I don't have a copy of it in front of me, but it was an attempt by Dave and myself to think about some legitimate possible scenarios that the Arboretum could do. And each one of them was the suggestion that if you want to be good, you have to be good at some one or two things. You can't be good at six or eight. Mm-hmm. And so we were suggesting if you want to be good at a nature center, just do it and forget the restoration mm-hmm. work, given the current financial and staffing.
And I think Dave did a pretty good job. He may have had the document in front of him because mm-hmm. I think he listed some of the scenarios.
Yeah,
I think
okay.
I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't confusing what you were talking about with what he was talking about.
No.
It sounds like there are
two different things.
There's a couple of things on your notes that I found. Well, I found it all interesting, but I want to make sure if we haven't touched on it. Right at the end, you said you wanted to reflect upon three signal events. One of them you alluded to already in sort of the 1999.
Yeah, that was the...
You have three signal events in the recent Arboretum history. Arboretum is public park and horticultural garden that have proven to be significant turning points or tipping points.
Okay, let me get my notes here.
So, if you wouldn't mind talking about that once you get your notes assembled, and I also want to make sure I give you space to make sure, you know, if there's anything else you want to say.
Okay, so it's about 2:15.
Yeah. And okay.
So I just, for the record, I'd forgotten one accomplishment that I am proud of that I didn't mention.
Okay.
And that was the last thing I did under a strategic plan developed in 2010. And that was to revise and bring up to date the biological or restoration master plan written in 1992 by the Arboretum ecologist Virginia Klein. And I formed a committee, a team of staff colleagues and faculty members, and we worked for about a year. This was in late 2009 through 2010, and we developed some new concepts and ideas that would govern the management of the Arboretum, govern the restoration ecology program for the next 25 to 30 years. So we got that approved in concept by the Arboretum Committee. And so I think that was a good thing. So the signal events, I mentioned one, which I think were good ideas, but proved to be a mistake in the long term. And that's the Wisconsin Native Plant Garden in addition to the Visitor Center. As I said, they used one-time monies to initiate a project that took on long-term costs. It distracted staff time and energies, and it diverted much-needed monies from land care to building construction and maintenance. And this caused a lot of stress to the staff. And I know myself and colleagues Molly Murray and Mark Leach, after that time, spent a lot of our work time in meetings and planning and discussions and reviewing drawings and blueprints and working with contractors. That all went away from our assigned jobs. I think another signal event that happened in 99 and 2000 was where Director Armstrong formed an executive team and he did a staff reorganization. And so he took a flat organization where everyone was pretty much equal and raised three people, myself included, Molly Murray, Mark Leach, the ecologist, and Joy Zedler, the research director, to an executive team, and then put everybody else in slots underneath us. And you might imagine, nobody liked that. Mm-hmm. And that caused a lot of turmoil and disarray, which I think is still being felt to this day. It created divisions among staff and created resentment. And after that point, we spent a lot of time in facilitated discussions with professional facilitators in Madison, coming to grips with decision-making and communications and organizational climate. And there's probably more than three signal events. And a third one I have was in 2006 and part of 2007, where there was a mass exodus of staff. Not all at once, wasn't a walkout, but there were 6 to 7 people who left for other jobs. And not necessarily because they were looking to leave the Arboretum, but just the turmoil and the what it took to work there, what it took to survive there was just too much for people. So we had, and these were talented people. We had Mark Leach, the ecologist. He went to Northland College. We had Libby McCann, who ran the Earth Partnership program. She went to Antioch College. We had Dave Zaber, who ran the IT program. He went to Northern Illinois University. We had Todd Miller, who went to Acadia National Park. He was also in the Earth Partnership program. So these people were talented, skilled, and made a great contribution to the Arboretum, but they just left because they couldn't take it any longer. Mm-hmm. And
Dave Egan left.
Dave left in 2006. He went to Northern Arizona University, where he worked for the Ecological Restoration Institute.
Steve, what are we... jump in here. What are we talking about in terms of, I mean, 6 or 7 people leave. How many people were there to begin with, say, you know, in late 2005?
I think there were 12 to 15. So it was a significant loss. Mm-hmm. All of those people were eventually replaced. But you're losing institutional memory. You have to start all over in training and everything.
So you said there might be more, but those are three for sure in terms of whatever we want to call them, turning points or tipping points.
There's another one I want to mention that has great meaning for me, symbolic meaning and actual impacts on the Arboretum. And that was in 2008 when the then director, Kevin McSweeney, decided that the way to raise money for the Arboretum was to appeal to donors who were interested in the horticultural collections, the Longenecker Horticultural Garden. A valuable contribution to the community, a valuable contribution to science, an important part of the Arboretum, but not its founding principle. It decided, apparently, that it couldn't appeal on the basis of its founding principle, which was ecological restoration. And what was incredible to me was that this was done on the eve year of the 75th anniversary of the Arboretum. Mm-hmm. To me, a restoration ecologist, when the organization says, we don't think ecological restoration is worthy of boasting about. It's not fundable. To me, that sort of closed the door on the Arboretum's restoration days. And I'm also saying, maybe Dave said this too, Director Armstrong, Greg Armstrong, he retired in 2004, and a member of the Arboretum Committee, Kevin McSweeney from the Soils Department, was appointed the interim director. And there was a national search. He applied for the position and was appointed the permanent director in 2005. On the day he was to start work as the permanent director, he was diagnosed with colon cancer. Terrible news. I mean, here's a guy in the prime of his life, has a family, has a big new job, and he's come down with colon cancer. So everybody felt for him. And it was unfortunate because he couldn't devote himself to being a director and being a patient both. And so there were vast stretches of time when he wasn't present because he was either receiving treatment or recuperating. So I think that marked the beginning of a period of leaderless drift, which continues to this day because we don't have a permanent director. And I don't fault Director McSweeney. And he didn't want to get sick, and he didn't want to give up his job. But I do fault the graduate school for not taking steps to correct this. I mean, they probably didn't know what to do either. Who wants to kick a cancer patient out of his job? But it's just unfortunate that that situation was allowed to drag on for 6 or 7 years. And so Kevin McSweeney finally regained some health, and then in 2012 he went back to full-time teaching in the Soils Department.
There's a lot to digest.
A lot to digest.
But I appreciate it all. Maybe one last thing, because I don't think you've talked about it.
Okay.
And that's, you have here in your notes, address the contribution of the Arboretum as restoration ecology laboratory and practice field to the discipline in general and to the environmental movement in Dane County and Wisconsin in the 80s and 90s. So maybe not so much restoration ecology in general, although I'm sure that's interesting, but mm-hmm. let's sort of focus it on what you want to say in terms of the Arboretum being a place that helped the county and the state in terms of restoration ecology and environmentalism.
Well, a lot of students went through the Arboretum, either in the Landscape Architecture Department or the Botany Department or the Institute for Environmental Studies. So they received a lot of field work in plant identification, restoration techniques, wildlife ecology. So the Arboretum was and is a laboratory in that regard and a training ground for many students. And in the 70s and 80s, there weren't many places like that around. And I think the students who went through school and graduated in the 70s and 80s have gone on to be leaders in the local and state environmental movements. Folks like Rich Henderson, who got a degree in the Landscape Architecture Department and is now working with the DNR and is a leader in the Prairie Enthusiasts. Or Sidney Holtz, who also got a degree in Landscape Architecture, worked at the Arboretum for a time and went on to become head of the DNR's Bureau of Endangered Resources. Thomas Myers, who is head of the DNR's Natural Heritage Program. People like that, countless people who went on because of their experience at the Arboretum and the resources it provided. Nationally and internationally, I think the Arboretum will always be important because it's considered the birthplace of ecological restoration. And Bill Jordan coined that term, which gave the practice an identity. People were doing this work but didn't know what to call it, didn't know what it was. So it sort of legitimized their profession. And made it okay, and made it something to aspire to be restoring these native plant communities. The Society for Ecological Restoration, which is now a global organization, was formed out of the work of Bill Jordan and others at the Arboretum, and is incorporated in Madison, and recently held its fifth World Conference in 2013, where 1,500 people from around the world, 60 countries or more, came to Madison for this conference and to see the work that was done at the Arboretum. So it's got a global legacy, a global trademark, and the work that was begun at the Arboretum and in other places, including Australia and in Arizona and in Illinois and Minnesota, about the same time, has gone on to become this global enterprise. Okay. Some aspects it is an enterprise because there are a lot of businesses involved in ecological restoration, but it's a professional discipline.
I have one more thing. Let's see if I can find it. It was another thing that Dave said that the two of you did together. You and Dave gave a presentation at a NESER conference in Seattle. I think it was something about perhaps a community interface between that. It was tough to interesting to do restoration in the Arboretum with this outside force, the urban environment around it. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, I think we were talking about cross-boundary influences.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you wouldn't mind, what you remember of that, the paper about cross-boundary influence or just cross-boundary influence in general at that time.
Well, to define cross-boundary influences, we're talking about things that flow across the boundary of any property, and in this case, the Arboretum, and that includes things that move in the water, like stormwater and stormwater pollutants, things that move in the air, like nitrogen deposition. It includes neighbors who use the land for ill or good. And the idea that we were building upon that was proposed by another researcher, and I forget her name at this point, she should get credit for this idea, was that organizations, protected areas like the Arboretum, can expand those boundaries, can create a social buffer around their protected area by engaging with the citizenry, by cultivating an interest in the protected area, in the restoration in this case, and in giving them education and getting them engaged in it and giving them ways that they can act creatively and in ways that help enhance the organization. And I think the Arboretum has done that pretty good. It has a group of volunteer stewards. These are folks who are trained in Arboretum history and lore and ecology, and they patrol the grounds on a regular basis, interacting with visitors and serving as ambassadors and educational rangers and sometimes enforcement rangers. Mm-hmm. Done that. The Arboretum engages a lot of volunteers in restoration projects, and those folks get some exposure to what we're doing.
Okay. And Steve, is there anything else? I want to make sure, let me give you a second maybe to look through your notes there and make sure there's nothing else that you'd like to add.
Well, while I'm looking, I would just say that I've enjoyed the opportunity to talk about my experience at the Arboretum and talk about the opportunities and constraints and some of the frustrations that I experienced. I would also like to say that, well, you've seen me. I'm prowling through documents here, so I'm not speaking extemporaneously. I'm speaking from records and official documents, and I've put my recollections down and checked it against facts. And I just wanted to make sure I had listed all of the people who sort of left en masse. So Mark Leach, Northland College. Libby McCann left and went to Antioch University. Dave Zaber left, went to Northern Illinois. Dave Egan left and went to Northern Arizona. Tom McClintock is another person I failed to mention. He was a part-time person at the Arboretum and developed our IT program. And he also worked half-time at the UW's Land Information and Computer Graphics Facility. LICGF is the name of it. I think that used to be in the basement of Steenbach.
Okay.
Here. But sometime, and I think around 2006, maybe a little before, he left the Arboretum and went full-time on campus. So. Oh, and then Todd Miller was also part of the Earth Partnership program. He left in late 2006 and went to Acadia National Park in Maine.
Okay.
And then maybe Dave mentioned this. I also want to mention it that in 2010, although discussions about this decision probably began in late 2008. The Arboretum director, Kevin McSweeney, decided that the Arboretum could no longer support the journal Ecological Restoration. This was the journal founded at the Arboretum in 1981. And it's still published by the UW Press, but its home is now at Rutgers University. And the graduate school rationale for this was that, well, departments don't publish journals. So it's a strict academic perspective on this, and I can understand that and respect that. But on the other hand, this was one of the best things the Arboretum has ever done, this journal. And to see it leave was heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still being published, and so it's still contributing to the field.
Well, Steve, I want to thank you for your time today.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.